For the week of October 18th, 2009, this is Showbiz Sandbox, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines in the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Karen Woodward.
And in Kansas City, Kansas, in the heart of barbecue country, I'm Michael Giltz.
What are you doing in Kansas?
I'm on a barbecue road trip hitting about 5 restaurants in Kansas City, Kansas, or Missouri, depending on which part of town you're in. Arthur Bryant's, Gates, LC's, I'm hitting all the big ones.
Now, is this just something you're doing for yourself or are you on assignment?
I've assigned myself the job of going to eat in 5 barbecue places.
Well, Ollie Gates' place is really well known, of course. It's a big Kansas City institution, but I found it to be okay, not great.
Well, I can't wait to let you know what I think.
Well, will you let us know what you think of the box office this week?
I certainly will. It's been an exciting week at the box office. Number one for the week is Where the Wild Things Are, which opened to a very strong $32 million. Number two is Law Abiding Citizen, starring the increasingly anonymous Gerard Butler and the Oscar-wasting Jamie Foxx. that made $21 million. Number three is Paranormal Activity, definitely the indie film of the year. It grossed $20 million on only like 700, 800 screens. It's already up to $33 million with a budget of $11,000. Number four is Couples Retreat, which dropped 50% to $17 million for a total of $62 million. Number five is the standard issue Halloween horror movie, The Stepfather, a remake. That made $12.3 million. Number six is Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs, which made another $8 million and broke through the $100 million barrier. Number seven is The Very Fun Zombieland, which made $7.8 million for a total of $60 million. Number eight is the Toy Story 2 reissue, which now has a total of $28 million. Number nine is Bruce Willis's anonymous Surrogates, the sci-fi flick that came and went. Number 10 is The Invention of Lying with Ricky Gervais, fading out with a total of $15 million. Roger Moore's Capitalism, A Love Story, still chugging along and made another $1.4 million, which again is more than most documentary films ever make in their entire life. And it's already at a total of $11 million.
Wait a second. Roger Moore did a documentary?
Roger Moore of 007 did a documentary. I met Michael Moore.
I was like, wow, that's... I don't know where I've been.
Capitalism, A Love Story. And then in limited release is New York, I Love You, which New York did not really love that much. Which made $372 million to terrible reviews. And the Coen brother movie, A Serious Man, is still out there. That's at $1.8 million. And that's it for the box office. Did anybody else see Where the Wild Things Are?
I did not see it. Did you see it?
I have no desire whatsoever to see that.
You have no heart?
Well, I think that's established. But I think the movie looks boring.
Well, I love the trailer. And then Variety and Hollywood Reporter came out with very polite but mixed reviews, saying it was too long, nothing happened, they respected it, but no. And I was like, oh, bummer. And then Manola Dargis, who I don't really like, but she gave it a flawed but brilliant review. Her comment about the movie was that it was flawed but brilliant, and my friend at the Daily News really liked it a lot. I started to get excited again. I went and saw it this afternoon, and I really went for it, hook, line, and sinker. It's just very simple, very sweet, but it's the little kid is great. The kid who plays Max is called Max in real life. It's all him. He's 98% of the movie. He's really good.
He's adorable. I will give you that. He is really adorable.
He's really adorable. You go with it. They're very HR Puffin Stuff type creatures. That's what they went for, but with a lot more facial mobility so that they can actually express things. So it's like people in a suit, but they're able to get a lot bigger range of emotion. And so you've got all these good actors like James Gandolfini and Lauren Ambrose and Paul Dano who do the voices of the creatures, the wild things. And I just went with it totally. I mean, I cried like a baby.
But really?
No, I didn't cry. But I liked it a lot.
It got mixed reviews, as you said. It scored a 68% on Rotten Tomatoes. And there was the rumor mill was spinning out of control for over a year on that film, that it was horrible, that Spike Jonze had to reshoot certain scenes and that he had to recut the film. And so I'm sure Warner Brothers, the studio that released the film, is breathing a huge sigh of relief. I noticed Paranormal Activity has been a trending topic on Twitter for what seems like 2 weeks. And I know we're going to be talking about Twitter and Hollywood later in the show, so I don't want to jump ahead, but I'm just surprised it's always there.
It's an amazing release pattern. It went from like 5 to like 30 or 50 to 130. Now it's at like 700 plus. And every step of the way, it increased its per screen average, which even average folk know now about per screen average. And it opened on 10,000 screens, but had a weak per screen average, you know, that sort of stuff. And until the final big widest opening, it still has a great per screen average. But every earlier stage, normally the per screen average gets smaller because you're on four screens versus 100, but it was getting bigger. So the word of mouth on this has just been phenomenal. And now as it platformed pretty wide, 700 plus screens, and again, $20 million, Hollywood just wastes its money opening movies on 3,000 screens.
Well, speaking of full houses, I got an email from Harry Medved over at Fandango, who of course was on our show talking about Comic-Con. In his email, he talked about the Michael Jackson film, This Is It. Apparently, it has already sold out 1,000 performances. It is outselling all of the films on Fandango, including Twilight. It is 28% of the ticket sales on Fandango, which is saying something because they are one of the largest online ticket sellers in North America.
What does it mean to say it sold out 1,000 screenings? Well, how many tickets is that? Do we know, or equivalent box office gross, or what does that mean?
No, we don't know yet.
Okay. I mean, I bet it opens big, but again, it has to triple the highest grossing documentary film of all time to break even.
Not the highest grossing documentary film of all time, the highest grossing concert film.
I beg your pardon, you're quite right.
His email also pointed out that it was outselling and outpacing the Miley Cyrus film that you are now referencing.
Miley Cyrus, Best of Both Worlds?
Yes.
With the Jonas Brothers. Imagine if Michael Jackson had the Jonas Brothers opening for him. Everybody would have been like that. That would have been a win-win-win.
Oh my God.
Well, someone who is not winning these days is the Motion Picture Association.
That's a segue.
Yeah, there you go. Well, the Motion Picture Association of America's head, Dan Glickman, who took over for Jack Valenti in 2004, will be leaving the job as of September 1st, 2010, when his contract expires. Of course, Jack Valenti was the longtime head of the MPAA, the organization that rates your movies, at least here in North America, and the organization that lobbies Congress. Valenti, I think he was there for three decades, over 30 years, and he retired in his 80s. And apparently Glickman...
And then died.
And then immediately, yeah. I mean, he retired and then passed away within, I think, a year. Dan Glickman had been the former agriculture secretary, and he was a congressman from Kansas. And he was put in the job. He got the job, and it was a very much sought-after job. And I guess, you know, working in motion picture exhibition, I can tell you that, frankly, nobody was really thrilled with Dan Glickman. The studios weren't, at least, because...
Why?
Well...
What didn't he do?
Remember when the stimulus package was going through Congress? There was about $230 million in that bill for the studios. And Congress immediately took it off when they saw what a great year they were having at the box office, and Dan Glickman couldn't do anything about it. So rather than give him another five-year contract, which is what his first contract was for, they instead gave him an 18-month contract from December 2008 to September 1st, 2010. You know, he says he wasn't forced out. He says here, I'm going to be 65 next month, and it just struck me, this is a good time to really move on back into the world of either academia, public service, or nonprofits. Especially since they're kicking me out. Well, I added that last part.
My favorite quote is when he says that he's not thinking necessarily of running for a Senate seat in his native Kansas. And he says, we'll see if there's a groundswell from Kansas.
He may as well have said, hint, Kansas. Hello.
I'm in Kansas. I don't hear a groundswell, but if I see one, I'll let you guys know.
I was going to say, why don't you ask around?
How about that Glickman? He sounds like a Jiminy Glickman, you know, sounds like the Martin Short character.
I like his quote here. This is a very difficult job. From the outside world, this job has the perception of being very glamorous. People think Angelina goes home with me every night. It hasn't happened yet. And then he goes on to say the obvious. The industry is changing rapidly. The issues are becoming more complicated, particularly in the online world with all the new technology out there. It's just a good time to go.
Alrighty. Bye-bye, Glickman.
Bye-bye, Glickman.
Well, one thing that must be cheering him up, however, is the fact that home video rentals are up in the third quarter. Of course, with the economic climate being the way it is, and the way it is bad, DVD sales have plummeted, causing the studios to begin to contract because they were relying heavily on DVD sales. The overall home entertainment revenue, including DVD and Blu-ray sales, rentals, video on demand, and digital downloads and streaming, fell 3.2% in the third quarter to $4 billion. Just to give you some indication, the North American box office gross will be $10 million this year for the first time. It may not make it. $4 billion in one quarter for home video. So that should tell you how big that industry is and how much the industry depends on it. That decrease reflects the ongoing decline driven by the economic downturn and plummeting consumer interest in buying movies and TV shows on shiny discs. And this was a report put together by the Digital Entertainment Group and Industry Trade Association, which reported that rental revenue actually rose 9.9% in the three-month period ending September 30th, which is even faster than the 8.3% growth that they had anticipated. Of course, the problem there is that the profit margins on rentals are much lower than for sales.
You know, as I travel around the country, the idea that Redbox is hurting, DVD sales is so ridiculous. I can't tell you how many grocery stores, gas stations, rest areas I stop in, and there's DVDs for $5, two for five, $2 for $8, $6, DVD. It's just crazy. The DVDs are cheap. They're in grocery stores. They're $6, $8, $10. So they should be thrilled with Redbox, and they should all make a deal with Redbox, just like Paramount, and get a cut of the revenue.
Well, Reed Hastings, the CEO of Netflix, which is a DVD rent-by-mail company here in the United States, he said this past week or 2 weeks ago that shipping DVDs would only be the primary method of delivery for the next 2 years as streaming overtakes it, at least for Netflix.
2 years is ridiculously soon. There's no way. Only a third of homes have DVRs. There aren't that many homes with high-speed internet connections that can download, can stream a movie, easily. They always make these prognostications too quick. Oh, in 16 months, we'll all be streaming our video,
Well, now, mind you, he didn't say it would be the only form. He said it would be the primary form. So
it's not going to be, streaming isn't going to be 50% of rentals. There's no way. Look, it's a $4 billion, it's a $16 billion a year market. We're not going to do $8 billion on streaming. It's just not possible. There's not enough homes with high-speed internet connections. Only 30% of homes have a DVR, for God's sake. But we'll get to that later.
How many percentage of homes do you think are on Twitter? Because there was an AP story, or sorry, a Reuters story this past week that said...
Damn, he linked us. He segued us. Okay, keep going.
wait. What's that? Segway?
It's that thing that you ride, just by standing on it. It's one of those, kind of like a scooter. But anyway.
No, I just love it when you do that, Sperling.
Well,
yeah, I did too.
Well, I'm trying to, race through some stories here before we get to our guest, Mark Berman of Media Week, who will be talking to us about television.
Yay.
But Reuters had a story about Twitter on, Twitter on television. They had a story that was, in my opinion, a non-story about movie studios opening their ears to online buzz. I thought the story was written for people, I don't know where. I mean,
there are two stories here, I think. And the Reuters story is the non-starter story. I agree that studios are starting to realize that, the internet exists and people talk on it. And... And, that was the reason why Bruno didn't do well, because of bad word of mouth like that the first weekend. People are like, Friday night makes a difference now. It's not just the weekend. People go see a movie on Friday night. They get on Facebook. They get on Twitter. They get on any other social media channel, and they put it out there, whether it's good or bad. And I think for a long time, studios were like not paying attention to that. I didn't think that could actually affect their business. And they finally realized, I think this summer, that, wow, it actually can.
Wait a second. Is this internet thing where all my email comes from?
Yeah, it's unbelievable, right? I mean, and which is part two of this story is that now studios are starting to kind of wake up, and they're starting to put into actors' contracts that, what they can and cannot say on social media. So it's kind of starting to go back to the days of the 30s and the 40s when studios sort of owned actors and were in charge of what they could say. Because right now, actors, there's nothing in their contracts that says what they can and cannot say in their real life. And their Twitter has been part of, it's been an extension of their real life. But when you're a celebrity, your Twitter and your Facebook is an extension of your brand.
There are always clauses in contracts that talk about how an actor or a director or a writer can talk to the press. So this is just an extension of that.
Well, yeah, but then you know, people, that's really the big question is social media considered press? I mean, there's always been kind of talking points, and especially if like an actor, you know, dies on a TV show or, you know, things like that, that they're kind of told what they can and cannot say. But they've never had that in terms of what they can say on their social media channels. And now Disney includes a clause forbidding confidentiality breaches via interactive media such as Facebook, Twitter, or any other interactive social network or personal blog that is now in their contracts.
Right. Right. But as Sperling says, it's like if you can't breach confidentiality, you can't do it in any way, shape, or form. You right. can't do it to a reporter. You can't do it by posting on Facebook. You can't take a billboard out on, you know, the L.A. Strip, Sunset Strip. Yeah, it's just you can't do it. But yeah, they're sort of.
But now they're getting specific.
Unnecessarily, legally, I think, you know.
Well, they don't call it social media for nothing.
Yeah.
What I like, though, is that some of these actors and actresses and media types are actually getting into trouble by getting into spats, both fake and real, over Twitter. There was Perez Hilton versus Demi Moore, and Perez Hilton, of course, being the gossip columnist, the online gossip columnist. Spencer Pratt, a reality star, versus Ryan Seacrest, the host of American Idol. Football star Terrell Owens versus a sports announcer, and Christy Alley versus apparently just about everyone.
Well, most of them haven't gotten in trouble. They've just made exciting, controversial things, you know, and they're in the news. So we're talking about Christy Alley, so I call that a win-win for her.
Well, there was Greg Grunberg from Heroes who got sort of busted when he said on Twitter, he made a comment, something about, I hope we see the crew again next season or something like that, that what he really meant was that crew members change over frequently from, you know, from season to season on a show. And everybody else thought that to mean the show's going, you know, being canceled. That's
because, so, and, because it's going to be canceled.
I know. But so he got really busted for that. But you know what? He got busted for that. But he ended up on the cover of the LA Times to talk about it. So that was like really good. It was really good PR for, you know, for him and all everything that he does on the
and
side
the
and for the show. Yeah. And
Matea Gold of the LA Times, speaking of the LA Times, wrote a story about this whole thing last Monday, so October 12th. And in it, she wrote, in rushing to Rumble on Twitter, stars are bypassing publicists long entrusted with shaping their images and offering a peek at their unadulterated personalities behind their public facades. The blunt postings alarm public relations professionals who have traditionally exerted stringent control over what clients dole out to their fans. And then the quote here is from Alan Mayer, the head of strategic communications division at publicity firm 42 West, a big PR firm both in New York and LA. And he says, giving some celebrities Twitter is like giving a kid a loaded gun. Twitter can be enormously valuable as a branding tool, but like everything else, it's a double-edged sword. And if you have impulse control problems, which strangely a lot of celebrities seem to have,
it
can be very dangerous.
he's 100% right. I mean, when you're a celebrity and you've got a Twitter, it's an extension of your brand as a celebrity. It is not an extension of you, the person. It's just the nature of celebrity.
I think Stuart Fischoff, an expert in media psychology, noted that the nature of Twitter makes it feel deceptively private. So I guess he's agreeing with you, Karen. While celebs are confronted by a bank of cameras and shouting reporters in other public forums, tweeting is a solitary activity. So I guess sitting there at their computer, they feel like they can say something that they wouldn't necessarily say to a room of 2,000 people.
I think I hear what he's saying, and I think that does make sense. You don't always realize like how many followers you have when you hit send or share or whatever. But I think so much of it, and this is why I hate Twitter, is that it's so narcissistic. And people could argue it's the same thing about Facebook, but there's something about Twitter to me that's even worse. It's like, It's a celebrity almost reveling in their celebrityness. There's something just intensely disgusting about it.
There's that old quote from Laurence Olivier about why he became an actor. And he said, I'd like to say it was all about the language in Shakespeare. But no, it's all about me, me, me. Look at me.
It's true.
That's too long a quote to fit onto Twitter. He needs to shorten up his quotes.
Well, we'll get that over to him right away.
Me, period. There you go. Plenty of space for retweeting everything.
Well,
how about just me, period, headline.
Well, leave it to Jeffrey Cole, who who is studying new media at the USC Annenberg School of Communications and Journalism, who noted the explosion of combative posts marking a shift in how celebrities are using Twitter. He said to Matea Gold, "To be in the middle of some of these celebrity feuds just takes celebrity presence in your life to a level that People magazine and Entertainment Tonight could never have imagined," which I think is very true.
Oh, it's unquestionably true. And that it's just an extension of my argument that, celebrities who are on Twitter and tweet all the time are just complete narcissists. It's like Entertainment Weekly and Us Weekly and People is just not enough for them. I mean, they just have to make sure that everybody knows that they are around like 24/7.
Well, something that is around 24/7 is television. And with us to discuss television today is Mark Berman, who works for Media Week. He is the senior television editor at Media Week and creator editor of the Programming Insider, a daily online Bible that reaches more than 50,000 readers per day. Berman is also the author of the weekly Mr. Television column, the creator of Berman on TV, a series of webcasts about television, the syndication reporter and webmaster for PIfeedback.com, an online chat room. Thank you for joining us, Mark.
My pleasure.
Now, we have a number of stories that we've highlighted to talk about, including Jay Leno and some of the reality television news of the week. But one of the reasons we wanted to talk to you was you rated all of the freshman series in your column, which can be found on at markberman.tv or the Programming Insider, Media Week.
I've been a subscriber for years. I've been getting his daily ratings. Some kids read the baseball box scores when they got up in the morning. I would read the TV ratings. So I love Mark's.
So I love Mark's. TV ratings are like an addiction. It's totally addictive.
Exactly. And so your rankings of the shows are not critical reviews, but they're rankings of how the shows are doing given the time slot and where they're at, et cetera.
Yeah, and, exactly.
I think the highest rated show is an A. There's no A plus, right? Perhaps A.
Well,
is as high
there
as
wasn't you... there was an A plus initially. NCIS Los Angeles was an absolute A plus. It's now settled into an A. So that's the big hit of the season.
How did you come to the grade that you did? For me, seeing The Good Wife, which is a show that I personally really liked, see getting an A minus sort of surprised me.
Surprised you in a good way or a bad way?
Oh, I'm thrilled. I just didn't. I expected. I guess maybe it's because I don't have a lot of faith in the viewing audience sometimes. I just assumed that people would kind of give that like a B or even a C, but I think it's a fantastic show.
Well, you have to look at a show like The Good Wife, and the way I grade shows, for example, is it's on Tuesday at 10 o'clock, so it's facing the Jay Leno show on NBC. Everybody's facing Jay Leno, and The Forgotten on ABC. It is, by and large, the most-watched show in the hour. The retention out of its lead in NCIS Los Angeles is solid. And it's also winning the hour among adults 18 to 49. It's not a huge demo, but it's still winning, and that's an A-.
Another ABC show that seems to be doing well, according to you, to your ratings here, is Flash Forward on ABC.
Yeah, what do you think about that show?
Well, Flash Forward definitely has water cooler conversation. It's reminiscent to some extent of Lost. Now, it's certainly not anywhere as big as Lost was in its first season, but the positive news for Flash Forward is it seems to have settled in. It's doing about 9.5 million viewers. It's a solid second among adults 18 to 49 behind Survivor. So basically, it's probably ABC's most watched show Thursday 8 o'clock in several years, and it's doing much better than what Ugly Betty was doing. So all in all, Flash Forward looks like a good show, and it's a B. I give it a B. I'm like a teacher on grading shows.
And as a and as a viewer, though, it leaves you a bit cold, doesn't it?
Well, you know, Flash Forward is one of those shows where, you know, once you watch, I mean, there's more and more things going on. You don't know what's happening. So it's very open-ended, very much like Lost. Lost is, by and large, my favorite show. I'm not actually into Flash Forward, I have to be honest. I'm not addicted to it. I'm kind of like I kind of don't want to jump into it because I still watch Survivor. But, I mean, in terms of the ratings, in terms of what people are saying, it's doing well for ABC.
So what's been the biggest flop of the season?
The biggest flop has to be the Jay Leno show, absolutely the Jay Leno show. Now, first of all, he's running five nights a week. He basically is finishing third in the time period, which is last, every night of the week. And it's bad news. He's not holding. If you look at, like, for example, last year, Tuesday night, the network aired Law & Order SVU. I mean, he has dropped significantly from that show. He's dropped basically across the board. His demo rating in 18 to 49 is very low, which means that it's an older skewing show, and he's not providing lead-in support to the local late newscast. So all in all, Jay Leno is, in my opinion, a colossal flop.
Well, both the New York Times and the LA Times had stories, the New York Times last week, the LA Times this week, regarding just that, the effects of the debate over what they're calling the Leno effect. And mm-hmm. the New York Times talked about how, of course, we discussed it a couple of episodes ago, how this lead-in to the news, all of the NBC affiliates' news shows at 11 o'clock are dropping in double digits, between 10 and 30%.
Yes. Yes. It's very bad news. I mean, look, this was the biggest risk I've ever seen a network take. Not only did they take a risk in primetime, they moved Jay Leno out of late night, and Conan O'Brien is not delivering as many viewers. So that show has lost steam. But this is a huge gamble. It's not paying off. It's a huge problem. And what they cannot do is they can't decide, well, we'll only air it two or three nights a week. It's either five nights or it's no nights.
I know that one of the things they offered him was a Sunday night three-hour extravaganza like Ed Sullivan, a variety show where he'd do everything. They could perhaps say do that maybe. Maybe that would work. Make it once a week event.
Well, at this point, nothing they do is going to work with him. I mean, you have to look at it logically. The show's been on the air now. Look, this show started out on its first night with 18 million viewers. 18 million viewers. It's a lot of people watching. Now, nobody expected that show to hold those levels as the weeks progressed. But, I mean, he's barely doing 5 million viewers a night now. So, I mean, people are just not interested. They're not
Isn't that what he was doing late night? 5-6 million viewers?
Yes, but late night is not... Yes, but remember, late night is not prime time. You have the HUD levels, which are households using television, are much higher at 10 o'clock than they are at 11:35. There's no comparison. People are going to bed. If you're getting 5 million viewers at 11:30 at night, that's good. If you're getting it at 10 o'clock in the evening, that's not good.
But wasn't it stupid after...
I have to be honest, from a critical standpoint, just speaking as a viewer, I don't like the show. I think the show is very stale.
Terrible. Wasn't it dumb of NBC to think that after 20 years on the air that suddenly he would draw more viewers just because he was on an hour and a half earlier? You know, people knew Leno. There's no way he was going to add 5 million people or double his audience to 8 million to 10 million just because he moved to 10 o'clock. It was crazy.
It was crazy. And they have said that their expectations are low. It doesn't have to get great ratings for them to make money because it does cost a lot less to run this show 5 nights a week. They're not paying talent. The production costs are not as expensive, so they are saving a lot of money. But even if you look at what the expectations were versus what he's delivering, it's still a disappointment, and it's a terrible, terrible sign for network television.
To your point, Jeff Gaspin, the chairman of NBC Universal, said that the decision was all about money and that they will make money, the network will make money with Jay Leno at 10 o'clock.
Yes.
The New York Times said the rationale for the move of Mr. Leno was simple. The network could not endure his likely move to ABC, where he would have created a new late-night program and undermine the strength of The Tonight Show, which we discussed a few weeks ago.
That's a lame excuse, by the way. That's a lame excuse. Because first of all, even let's say if Jay Leno went to ABC and competed with Conan O'Brien. Okay. Jay would have gotten more viewers. Conan would have probably brought in more younger viewers. So that's a lame excuse. He could have gone to ABC. Jay Leno was not God. Let's be honest, all right? He did well on The Tonight Show. It wasn't spectacular. It was respectable. So they could have very well lived if he moved to ABC and competed against The Tonight Show. That wasn't the issue here. The issue was, plain and simple, NBC's priority is saving money. And that's what they've done. They have saved money. But you know what? You have to look at the whole picture, and the whole picture is by putting Leno on 5 nights a week, they had to move Law & Order SVU, they had to move Law & Order, they canceled Southland, so the rest of their schedule is a disaster area.
And the producer of Southland, John Wells, kind of dinged NBC in the New York Times piece. He said, "I'm disappointed that NBC no longer has time periods available to support the kind of critically acclaimed series that was for so many years a hallmark of their success. And now there's some talk, or some theories, according to the Los Angeles Times, that if the bulk of affiliates start to suffer heavy financial setbacks, NBC could pull Leno back a half hour, and the stations could start their local news at 10 p.m. instead, and then he would start at 10:30, or they could move the Jay Leno show up to 8 p.m. and push all of their other programming back."
They can't. They can't do that. They can't. Because, first of all, I mean, They are in such bad shape now, and if let's say they said we're moving Jay Leno to 8 o'clock every night, I mean, what are they going to do with The Biggest Loser? What are they going to do with the other shows airing every night? I mean, they'd have to slide everything down. Viewers are not going to know what show is on when. people are going to tune out in droves. They're going to absolutely shoot themselves in the foot, and they're already wounded. So basically, the bottom line is this. They did this experiment. It was a big gamble. It's not paying off. I personally think they have to live with it for the season, and then they have to deal with it next year and get him off the schedule. That's what I think. That doesn't necessarily mean they'll do what I'm thinking, but they can't move him to 8 o'clock five nights a week. It's impossible.
Well, a few
they have problems on their whole schedule. NBC's got to be the worst shape of all the networks, with the exception of the CW.
NBC is in horrible shape, horrible shape. If you look at their schedule, the only thing that's working for them right now, The Biggest Loser on Tuesday is good, 8 to 10. That's fine. The Office brings in a young adult demo at 9 o'clock on Thursday. Sunday Night Football brings in a large audience. But, of course, Sunday Night Football goes away in January, and then they have to reprogram Sunday. The rest of the lineup is a disaster area. It's really in very sad shape. And when people didn't realize this, you know, Jay Leno, Jay Leno, Jay Leno, but because they put Jay Leno all over the place, they had to move everything else. Viewers that watched SVU on Tuesday at 10 o'clock for 10 years, we're not running to 9 o'clock Wednesday to watch it. So it's in, the schedule is in very, very bad shape. They are a disaster area.
Well, a few other shows that you consider disaster areas, Shark Tank on ABC Tuesdays at 8 p.m., you gave it an F. Community, which is on Thursday at 8 p.m.
Yeah, that
NBC.
Really surprised me, because that's a show that got a lot of buzz and got pretty decent reviews.
Well, you know what? First of all, I think NBC is going to stick with Community for the season. I'm grading based on the ratings. Now, initially, it was airing out of the office at 9:30. They were trying to give it some exposure. Now, it's not a strong enough show to anchor Thursday, so it's collapsing. And the problem with a show like Community, which is the same problem NBC has with Parks and Recreation, The Office, and 30 Rock, it's not the kind of a comedy that's going to attract a universal audience. The critics may like it. It'll have a small core, you know, viewers watching, but it's not going to be a mass appeal hit. NBC needs shows that are filmed in front of a live audience, like a Cosby Show, like a Cheers, like a Family
Two and a Half
Guy,
Men.
Friends. They don't have it anymore. They have to stop with these, you know, with these shows that are kind of like very edgy and very quirky and very creative. Give me a generic comedy with some cute kids, a wacky neighbor, a dog, and a sassy maid. That's what they need.
What do you
Anyone
think of Modern
who reads
Family?
Mark Berman regularly knows that he's a big fan of the traditional sitcom, and that you know, defends them whenever he can.
Well, listen, The Office does well for NBC. The Office has a very big base of 18 to 49 viewers, and I personally really like the show. There's nothing wrong with a show like that. But what NBC has abandoned is the traditional sitcom filmed in front of an audience, where, you know, you feel those old the shows they used to have, you know, Seinfeld, Cheers, Frasier. They don't do that anymore.
Another show that is a lot like The Office, a single camera sitcom, is Modern Family on ABC Wednesdays at 9 p.m. You gave it a B.
Yeah. It's doing very well, I have to tell you.
So is Cougar
Town. Well, Modern Family, you know what? The critics love it. I personally like it. It's doing very well for ABC. It's bringing in a decent-sized 18 to 49 rating, and it's doing well, and it's renewed for the full season, and it's the real deal, without a doubt.
What about Cougar Town, 9:30, right after Modern Family on ABC on Wednesdays? You gave it a B as well.
Well, what I like about Cougar Town is it's holding most of the lead in among adults 18 to 49. That's a very good sign. And it's very compatible with Modern Family, and I personally think it's a good show. I like Courtney Cox. I think ABC has something with both Modern Family and Cougar Town.
Now, a lot of the medical dramas, Mercy on NBC Wednesdays at 8, Three Rivers on CBS at 9:30 p.m., then there was Trauma. These are shows that you gave—
None of them are working.
Yeah, C's and D's. You gave them all C's and D's.
I'm like a teacher failing students here, but you know what? You know what? One of the themes of the new season of the new shows were medical dramas. We had three of them. None of them are working, and I'm not surprised. I knew they wouldn't work. I knew it. First of all, Three Rivers on CBS. I knew off the bat that viewers were not going to be interested in a serious medical drama about organ transplants out of The Amazing Race the night before they have to go back to work. It was too serious on a Sunday night, and I knew that the women were still going to watch Desperate Housewives. So it was in a bad slot. It was a mistake on CBS's part. Now, you have to remember that initially NBC was not going to be airing Mercy in the fall. They were going to run Parenthood, but they had to delay that to midseason. So that was really a last-minute arrival. It cannot anchor Wednesday. It's not strong enough. And then Trauma has no lead-in support from Heroes.
What do you make of this Live plus 7 ratings schedule that's being employed by networks these days. Technically, it's live plus three. They only count those 3 days right after the original viewing. But they're beginning to take the ratings from DVR viewings for the first 3 days and include them in the live ratings.
It's extremely important because a lot of people now, you know, viewers watch TV differently now. You don't have to watch a show live. You could DVR it. And, you know, certain shows that aren't bringing in a large, huge audience are doing well in DVR usage. For example, on Thursday at 9 o'clock, Fringe on Fox is not doing well overall based on the same-day ratings. But apparently, you know, based on the first week of the season, it had about 2 to 3 million more viewers that were DVRing it. So it's very important. And there needs to be more of an immediacy to get those ratings out there.
Heroes is another show that's doing quite well once you add the DVR ratings in. There was a story in the New York Times titled Later Viewings of Shows on DVRs Brighten Ratings. And Alan Wurzel, the president of research for NBC, said this confirms what we've known. The DVR is our frenemy.
Well, the DVR is very important, but Heroes is a dead show. Heroes is a dead show. It's in its fourth season. It lost its edge. Viewers lost interest. I mean, if I was working on Heroes, I wouldn't be checking the mail because there'll be a pink slip coming any day. It's ready to go. I mean, they'll cancel by the end of the season. It's done. Heroes is done, and that's another situation. Here's another thing. They put Jay Leno on at 10. They moved Heroes to 8 o'clock. You know, they put Trauma on at 9. Viewers don't know where these shows are running. They already announced that Chuck is coming back in midseason in place of Heroes. Heroes is gone. Yes, there are some viewers that are still DVRing it, but if you compare Heroes to its ratings just a few years ago, less than half the audience, more than half the audience has abandoned it.
I was really surprised that when looking at that story in the New York Times about DVRs, 44% of people watching the shows on DVR watch the commercials.
That can't be true.
I don't believe that, actually.
That came from Nielsen.
That comes from the ad and the Nielsen people. That's not possibly true. I don't know a single person who watches a show on a DVR and watches the ads. What I couldn't believe is that there are...
The beauty of a DVR is you watch and you could go right through the commercials. I mean, an hour show, you could watch in 44 minutes.
Exactly. What I can't believe is that they say DVRs are in a third of homes, but the most any show adds in viewers is, I think, the Grey's Anatomy, and it adds just 3 million viewers. I mean, I haven't watched a show on live in, you know, 95% of my TV viewing is DVR. And I you know, for those third of homes, I assume they're all DVRing, because who the heck watches a show live anymore? It's annoying.
A lot of people don't watch it live anymore. I personally still enjoy watching shows live. For whatever reason, I feel like I still feel the need to do that when I can, but I can't always do that. So if I'm watching a show that I DVR, I'm not watching the commercials. I'm not, because I don't want to, you know, I don't need to. Why do I have to? So I don't. And, you know, I want you to also remember that when I'm looking at these ratings, the live plus same day ratings, in the back of my head, I'm thinking, well, how's it going to do DVR-wise? Is it going to suddenly make the show a hit versus a flop? And to some degree, like I said, a show like Fringe is bringing in many more viewers with DVRs, but the majority of the new shows that aren't working live are not working with DVR usage either.
Well,
Jay Leno, for example. People are not DVRing Jay Leno or running home and watching him while they're eating dinner. They're not doing that.
What I found interesting was the way that Saturday Night Live tried to combat the DVR viewing by placing little interstitials in the middle of their commercial blocks of 30-second bits from old seasons. Mad Men does the same thing with their little title cards for each commercial, so that as you're quickly running through the commercials on your DVR, you can actually see these title cards on Mad Men or these interstitials on Saturday Night Live. You think that the show is back, and so you stop and you start watching again, and then meanwhile you've just watched a commercial, or at least the beginning part of a commercial.
It's sneaky. It's very sneaky.
And I find, frankly, that when you have a DVR, you're paying more attention to the commercials than you would if you were watching live, because when you're watching live, you can either tune out, look away, have a conversation, go to the kitchen and grab something to drink. With a DVR, you're sitting there staring at the television, so you know when to stop fast-forwarding.
That's a valid point. The way we rate television is very different now. It's not like the old days. There's many other facets to watching television. You could watch it online also. If you miss an ABC show or whatever, you go to the network's website, you can watch it. There's many other facets to watch shows now.
Is any network getting, do they get a final total viewing where they add live, plus 7-day DVR, plus how many times the show was streamed or watched on the network website or Hulu. Does anybody pull that all together to give you a final number of, you know, 18 million people watched this show or it was watched 18 million times, something like that?
No, I think, unfortunately, I think the viewing, you know, viewing on the internet, online viewing is still in its infancy, and they're still looking to ways to, you know, to come up with figures and monetize that. So it's very difficult to add everything up. I mean, you could certainly speculate, and there is some data, but there's nothing that pulls it all together. And unfortunately, it's not the same immediacy that you're getting. For example, today's Monday, or really tomorrow's Tuesday. I'm going to get the, you know, you'll get the final nationals for Monday on Tuesday, so it's a day later. So, I mean, you have to wait for all this stuff. So we just got the second week of the DVR usage in, and we're in the fifth week of the season.
Any surprises?
No, I mean, you know, some of the CW shows are getting DVR'd. I mean, you know, CW struggling, but a show like The Vampire Diaries is doing well in DVRs. I think, you know, Gossip Girl and One Tree Hill get some DVR usage as well. So, I mean, nothing that's too totally outstanding, but, I mean, and the rich get richer, you know, the shows that are, you know, that are leading the pack are getting a lot of DVR usage as well. So basically nothing too shocking.
Well, the Hollywood Reporter had an article about ranking shows by how old their audience is, because of course networks and their advertisers want to reach a young audience. Naturally, Vampire Diaries is doing really well there. Its average median age of its audience is 32, and the winner is the Cleveland show, which is has an average audience member of 28.
I know, that's incredible. It's incredible. The Cleveland show was already renewed for the complete second season. It's incredible.
And this is the spinoff of Family Guy.
This is a spinoff of Family Guy. It was originally supposed to start last spring. They delayed it till the fall. Before the show even premiered, they renewed it for 13 episodes in the second season, and now they just picked up 9 more for the second season. So they already committed to 44 episodes. It fits like an absolute glove out of The Simpsons and into Family Guy.
Well, and they might need to commit so far in advance because it is an animated series.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. And the nice thing about animation is the characters never get older.
That's true.
I mean, you know, it's not like a cute kid that suddenly at age 10 is like, oh my God, look at him. You know, they could keep him young and fresh.
Just ask Bart Simpson.
Like 2.5 men, which should now be called 3 men at the very least.
Exactly.
Or 3 boys.
I mean, that kid is as big as my size already, plus he needs a haircut actually, but that's besides the point. But yes, it should be 3 men now.
Well, in the middle
Hey, you know, actually, when that show ends, they could spin off Jake. He'll be in college.
What do you make of John Gosselin from John and Kate Plus 8, or now it's Kate Plus 8, on the Learning Channel? The Learning Channel turned around and sued John Gosselin last week for, I guess, talking to the press, giving an unauthorized interview.
Well, you know what? I'm going to be very honest here. I need a bucket because I'm going to barf. Because you know what? It's insane. It is insane. It's crazy. You know what? I do not understand why everybody is so interested in these two people. It's just mind-boggling to me. You know what? This was a show initially that was about a young family raising 8 children. Well, this couple went Hollywood. They were making a lot of money, and he's doing this and she's doing that. They're not together anymore, blah, blah, blah. Fine. Marriages break up, move on. But it's gotten so out of hand and so insane that it's an embarrassment. It's an embarrassment. And, you know, the whole thing with John, you know, deciding I'm not doing the show anymore. They had decided it was going to be Kate Plus 8. He was only going to be on periodically. He didn't like that. And suddenly he said no more. But you know what? What he needs to realize is eventually this is all going to end for him. So he should be riding the wave now and not getting off it. Kate, on the flip side, has already filmed a pilot for a daytime talk show. I mean, my only request with Kate is get another hairstylist that looks like her hair was cut by a lawnmower. It's ridiculous.
You know, I had no idea who these people were, and I think, what was it, Karen? Back in May or June, I asked you who they were, and frankly, I'm now sorry I found out.
It's insane. It's absolutely insane, and both of them are not doing a service for their careers. I mean, they should have kept their mouth shut, made their $75,000 an episode, and moved on, but they didn't.
Tell me, Mark, do you punish your kids if they don't watch enough TV?
Do I punish them? Well, let me put it to you this way. My mother was constantly saying, get out of the house and go out and play. Go out and play. Well, P.S., I'm Mr. TV now, so she was wrong, I was right, okay? But she forced me to join Bowling League on Saturday morning because I was watching cartoons. Well, P.S., you know, I was working back then. She didn't know it.
There's a reason you're called Mr. Television. You have the programming insider on Media Week. You've got The Programming Insider, the daily podcast, which you can subscribe to on iTunes. You're constantly being interviewed by Entertainment Tonight and Access Hollywood and Inside Edition. I'm sure that I'm skipping at least 1,000 different shows and networks that you appear on as an expert in television. Is there anything else besides, I guess, PI Feedback, which is it's a chat room.
Yes, it's a chat room, and if you want to talk about TV, go to pifeedback.com, and I have it set up. Every show has a category. We have the ratings. It's fun, and it's bringing in a lot of page views. It's doing very well. But I cover everything television, and if anyone would ever like to hire me as a host, I'm available. So
that's right. You can do freelance
there.
Work.
We can. I'll be on the John and Kate show. It could be John and Kate plus Mr. TV. I'll straighten them out.
Well, Mark, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us today about the new fall season. We look forward to speaking with you again in the future about all things television related.
My pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
That was very nice of Mark. I subscribe to his podcast and listen to it every day. It's very short, so it's only 10 minutes and you're caught up on all your television news. And his online stuff is fantastic. And Michael, you say you've been reading it for years.
Yeah, I've been getting his email list for years. I love those overnight TV ratings. I couldn't live without them.
I love that you're such a dork about that. Who knew?
Oh, yeah.
Well, we will place links to all of his many outlets and projects in the show notes. But right now, it is time for us to jump into our favorite new segment, Big Deal or Big Whoop, where we review the week's top entertainment news stories and decide whether they are a big deal or whether anyone will care about them.
I feel like we should have some sound effect there. Big deal or big whoop?
We need segment music. Is that what it is?
Yeah, exactly. Hit us up.
Well, okay. You highlighted a story, Michael, about music subscription services. Niklas Zennström and Jannes Friis, the two people who started Kazaa and Skype, they are starting a secretive startup called Radio, or RDIO. And it is hoping to introduce a music subscription service by early next year. It will offer a seamless access to music from both PCs and cell phones. The big challenge will be to get licenses from the major music labels, which have not viewed past digital music efforts by Zennström and Friis very favorably. Big deal or big whoop?
Big whoop.
Big whoop?
You'll never subscribe to music. You don't care. You don't listen to music or what?
I'm just waiting for somebody to do it better than iTunes does it.
Well, they don't really offer a subscription service, do they?
No, they don't. But I don't think subscription service is going to be the way to go. I don't think that's ever going to catch on the way it does. I think people want to own their music.
Well, here's the killer app. In Europe, they have a subscription service called Spotify, and the killer app has been that you don't just listen to it on your computer at your home when it's there. It's now on your mobile phone. And they do have all the major labels on board in Europe. And so if you have a phone that plays music, like an iPhone, you have access to like 7 million songs. You have everything you can think of, all the major new releases from all the labels. And you can hear it on your home, on your computer, on your stereo, or on your iPhone, which also means in your car or whatever. So it's really, to me, and it's worked really well. It's an ad-based service, so you can get it for free, and you hear ads every 20 minutes. Or you can pay $14 a month and you get everything, access to everything unlimited with no ads whatsoever. So a new album comes out, you can play it tomorrow. And you don't have to just sit up in front of your computer. You can do it on the phone. You can do it in your car because you can plug your phone into your car. So to me, that really opens it up. And I'm not surprised Spotify did really well. And since they got the labels to sign on, I bet someone gets the labels to sign on in America. And if they do, I think that portability will really make the difference because until now, I had no interest in it.
No, I think I kind of don't care until it is relevant to me. And like you said, and until it's something that's really relevant to me, I probably won't care.
Well, Michael, I've always found that Pandora is a lot like Spotify here in the United States. And all of the labels are on Pandora, or at least most of them.
And that's worked really well. Are you happy with it? Do you like it?
Yeah, I mean, you can get it on your cell phone. You can get it at home. Yeah, it's nice. I really like the fact that, you know, it's part of the Music Genome Project. So you can actually just create channels with specific styles and genres, and they have you know, I guess editorially gone in and figured out which other music is like the music you have requested, and then feed it to you, and you can give it the thumbs up or the thumbs down, and it will give you other music like it.
You like Barbara Streisand? How about Celine Dion?
Precisely. So, but what we're saying here is big whoop.
Big whoop right now. I'll keep an eye on it.
Yeah.
You two will live stream their Rose Bowl concert from Southern California on the internet through YouTube this weekend. Big deal or big whoop?
Ugh, big whoop.
That's a completely big whoop. However, I will say I know a friend who knows the person who designed their set, which is really cool and allowed for so many people to attend the show because it sort of rises up in the middle and people surround you 360 degrees. And so they've got 95,000 people there rather than like 65,000. So that's pretty cool. But to see it streaming, who cares? That's old news.
Yes, it's the largest ever attendance for a concert at the Rose Bowl. And I don't know if you've ever been to the Rose Bowl, but I can tell you it's in this little ravine in Pasadena. And they're not really known for their parking spaces. So 95,000 people all trying to get there. It's going to be madness. All right. So we're saying big whoop. Everybody's in agreement. Big whoop.
Yes.
Okay. Nicolas Cage, Sue's former business manager. Full disclosure, I used to work for Nicolas Cage's production company. Apparently, Nicolas Cage, the actor, producer, I believe he's also directed a film. He is suing his business manager or former business manager for $20 million for giving him bad advice and mismanagement, which led him toward financial ruin.
Big whoop.
I say big whoop because he should be suing Lisa Marie Presley for making him sell his comic books before he married her because that was unconscionable. Bad managers are old news, but someone who won't marry you until you get rid of your most prized possession is just...
What? That's ridiculous. How could she possibly make him do that?
I haven't gotten over it. I thought it was horrible. I'm like, dude, if she asks you to sell your comic book collection, she doesn't really love you.
Yo, I totally agree. That's a big deal.
But why can't people get... Don't they have outside accountants to check up on these people? I don't understand why this still happens. But
yeah, I know. That's what I'm saying. Big whoop. Sucks to be you, Nick Cage. Moving on.
That brings us to our final segment of each episode, Inside Baseball, in which we discuss topics and issues and subjects that only people in Hollywood might care about. This week, we will be discussing Bob Iger outlining the role of a modern studio chief. Bob Iger is the CEO of Disney, and of course, Disney's Dick Cook resigned or was forced out on September 18th, quite suddenly. He said in a keynote address sponsored by the USC Gould School of Law and the Beverly Hills Bar Association, "The primary responsibility, aside from creating value for the shareholders, is to choose good movies. I also think it's really important..."
What?
That's ridiculous. Unless he means by good, he means commercially successful. That's absurd.
Well, he says, "I also think it's really important that the person who's making those decisions has a business sense as well. Those two go hand in hand."
My God, this guy's a genius!
Yes, because a good movie that costs $800 million and grosses $30 million is not a good business decision.
It's not going to make money in foreign. The Post, which is on the LA Times, goes on to talk about how Iger discussed publicly the DVD sales and how they were shrinking, and he was the first person in Hollywood to publicly address the elephant in the room, telling investors earlier this year that the lucrative home entertainment business was suffering from more than just an economic downturn. It's undergoing permanent change.
Did you say what that permanent change is?
No, not really. He did mention that there are other forms of entertainment, like updating Facebook statuses and playing online games, which are vying for viewers' free time.
Yeah, I think the LA Times gave him too much credit there.
Well, and he did go into something that will tick off every single theater owner in the world. He says, "As I look at our company, the business model that formed the underpinning of the modern-day motion picture business is changing right before our eyes in profound ways. That means you're going to have to change your business in profound ways, or you will no longer have a business. In order to keep the DVD business vital, that product has to be perceived as being fresh in the marketplace. Things in demand and viewed as successful and great can lose their luster quickly because so much more is released into the marketplace every day. The press to move the DVD window up, be it physical or digital, will grow because of that phenomenon." And what he's saying is, you know, the movie comes out in March and the he wants to move the window up from when the movie comes out in March to when the DVD comes out.
Yeah, I think he's wrong in every way. I think 3 to 4 months, which is what it is now, which is 12 weeks, is already really, really quick. It's typically 4 months later it comes out on DVD. And if it's in the theater for 4 or 5 weeks, if it's any sort of movie, that means 12 weeks later it's on the shelves. That's really quick. And anything quicker starts to just mess with your mind.
Yeah, somebody needs to explain channel conflict to this.
I'm really annoyed by everybody talking about DVD sales collapsing. How many times do they think people can buy, like, the complete Seinfeld on DVD? How many times can you buy Gone with the Wind? People never collected movies. They built a library on VHS and then really built a library on DVD. And now DVD sales are slowing down to where they should be because people will buy new releases or the occasional classic that they don't have. It's DVDs are like, this year they're going to be about $16 billion. What makes them think it should be $30 billion or $25 billion? It's crazy. It's gone down to a level where it will be for the future, and it's great.
Well, that's what one of the things he goes into in his keynote, that the average family has about 80 titles. And frankly, they're not going to replace all those titles with Blu-ray because there's not enough incentive to do so. And, you know, they're not going to buy many more titles. They have 80 titles.
The average family does not have 80 DVDs. You don't have 80. I don't know any regular person who has 80 DVDs.
Oh, I have hundreds of them.
That's a lot. No. You're not a regular person. I'm saying most people in America do not have 80 DVDs in their home.
How many do you think they have?
It depends if they have kids, but I would say, you know, I would be much more likely to believe, say, 40, you know, 40, yeah. You know, but 80 titles, that's a ton. That's a big library. Most people don't have 80, 100 CDs. They don't have 80, 100 books. That's a lot of DVDs. Let me leave with one comment, which, because people keep talking about the business, the movie industry in every level from the 60s to today has been growing and continues to grow. More tickets are sold every decade from the 60s to the 70s to the 80s to the 90s to the noughts, it looks like. We're going to increase pure ticket sales, not dollar grosses, but more people are buying more tickets and going to the movies decade by decade over that five-decade period. So more people are going to movies than ever before. Plus, you have VHS and now DVD sales, which is huge. Plus, you have video on demand and video rental. People buy and watch and go to the movies more than they ever have before in history. The idea that there's some downturn or whatever in the business, if you look at the market as a whole, is absurd.
Are you as mad as hell and you're not going to take it anymore?
Exactly.
Am I on this podcast?
Yes, you are, Karen. And so is Mark Berman, who I'd like to thank for joining us to talk about the fall season's new television shows, which ones work and which ones don't. We'll place links to all of his podcasts and blogs and chat rooms on the show notes. You can find the show notes at showbizsandbox.com, which is our website. You can also listen to the podcast there, or you can go to iTunes and subscribe to it there. In fact, why don't you rate it there and give it a 5-star rating?
Why don't you stop what you're doing right now? Go do that.
Exactly. Unless you're driving, in which case, you're
excited. Rate it anyway.
Yeah, rate it when
Pull
you get
over.
Home. You can also send us an email. The email address is dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. We will read the emails we receive on future shows. We'll also be listening to some voicemails from listeners on future shows. You can leave us a voicemail by calling 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. The music you hear at the beginning and end of each podcast is by MGMT, the popular indie group. You can find them on MySpace, myspace.com/MGMT, or their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael, you can be found at michaelgiltz.com. And of course, you're also on Twitter, @MichaelGiltz is your username. Karen, your username on Twitter is kwoody3939, and we can find you on industrynexus.com. I will be in Show East next week in Orlando, and in the meantime, and even while there, can be found on Twitter @Sperling. Until next week, play nice.